Today's episode is presented by Sweat Connected. Sweat Connected is a transformative way to work out. Sweat Connected has a mission to help you feel your best. Each expert instructor brings their signature method directly to you, wherever you are in the world, via Zoom. When you take a Sweat Connected class, you are able to interact with your instructor and other participants in class, just like you would in a live studio experience. Whether you have been a group fitness participant for years or newer, you will feel at home with Sweat Connected. Sweat Connected is exclusively offering our listeners 15% off the first class by going to sweatconnected.com and using the code POD. That's code POD, P-O-D, at sweatconnected.com for 50% off your class. Sweat Connected for all levels, all ages, all sizes, and all humans.
Hey guys, this is Eric and Jessica Carrier, the hosts of the Prairieland Paranormal Podcast.
If you're looking for a show that explores all things paranormal, with dramatic storytelling, historical research, relevant science, and witness accounts,
check out our show online at www.prairielandparanormalpodcast.com or through your favorite podcast player.
Monster Legend Podcast. In the dark of the night comes a shimmering light to guide you. All along the twisted roads in your mind, darkness grows. And the whispering trees blow a dark haunting breeze right through you. Telling tales young and old, I hope that you enjoy the show.
All right. Hello and welcome to Monster Legend Podcast. And this week, we are talking about the Northwest Territories. Northwest Territories is a region of northern and northwestern Canada, encompassing a vast area of forests and tundra. Throughout the most of the 20th century, the territories constituted more than one-third of the area of Canada and reached almost from the eastern to the western extremities of the country. Across the river from North America continent. Region in 1999 of the territory of Nunavut on the eastern portion of the Northwest Territories reduced the area of the latter by more than half. The Northwest Territories are bordered by Nunavut to the east, province of Saskatchewan, Alberta, and British Columbia to the south, and Yukon to the west. In the north, the territories extend far above the Arctic Circle to incorporate numerous islands, the largest of which are Banks and Prince Patrick. Several islands also are divided between the territories and Nunavut, notably Victoria and Melville. Yellowknife is the capital and largest city. The area is 519,000. 735 square miles, or 1,346,106 square kilometers. The population in 2016 was 41,786. In 2019, estimated at 44,826. Two main types of landscape blend into one another along the timberland, which runs southeastward from near the Mackenzie River Delta on the Arctic Ocean to northwestern Manitoba, and it's just west of and roughly parallel to the border with Nunavut. Southwest of this line lies the northernmost part of the Canadian boreal forest, extending westward to the mountain ranges that border Yukon, north and east, and then stretch of relatively barren grounds of the Arctic, reaches a flat, often poorly drained lowlands underlain by rock more than 1 billion years old in the east, and more varied terrain towards the west. Within each of these two regions, surface vegetation and animal life it supports varied soil and climatic conditions. The Mackenzie Mountains in the west and southwest contains the highest and most rugged relief in the territory. Elevations reach 9,098 feet or 1,773 meters at Named Peak in the southwest near Mount Sir James McBrien itself, 9,602 feet or 2,762 meters. The most favorable conditions are found in the Mackenzie Lowlands in the west central portion of the territories, where forests of black and white spruce, Myrtus sinensis species, extended north to the Mackenzie Delta. Only about 70 frost-free days, the growing season for arbutus plants is short. While it lasts, however, wildflowers and grasses flourish, and roots and cereal crops can be cultivated. Many species of valuable fur-bearing animals are found in the area, notably muskrat and beaver. Moose, wolves, black and grizzly bears, and mountain sheep and goats are also native. Although the climate of the Mackenzie Lowlands is milder than most of the remainder of the territories, it is still cool enough to limit navigation on the Mackenzie River system to about 4 months a year and to cause a permanently frozen subsoil or permafrost, except in a small area south of Great Slave Lake. Permafrost creates serious construction problems, especially where the subsoil is an unstable mixture of fine silt and water. Scroll down. North and east of the Mackenzie Lowlands and the tree line, terrain changes to that of the ancient and rocky Precambrian mass known as the Canadian Shield, the western edge of which is straddled by the two largest lakes in the territories. Great Bear Lake, which is 12,096 square miles or 31,328 square kilometers, and Great Slave Lake, which is 11,030 square miles or 20,568 square kilometers. The Arctic Islands to the north comprise the remnants of mountains formed some 300 to 400 million years ago. Tree growth becomes sparse and stunted, and eventually disappears to be replaced by the light but tough vegetation of the Arctic tundra. In these so-called barren lands, the soils where they exist at all on the heavily glaciated surface are usually sandy and thin. Mosses, lichens, and many small hardy flowering plants survive in these conditions and support a variety of animal life ranging from small burrowing mammals and a predator, the Arctic fox, to large caribou and musk ox. The musk ox was in danger of becoming extinct until the Canadian government put it in under protection in the early 20th century, and several subspecies of caribou are now at risk. Seals, walrus, and polar bears are prevalent along the coast. Bird life is plentiful in summer, with some species, notably ptarmigans and ravens, remaining all winter. Mosquitoes and other insects abound during the summers. Yeah, I heard that mosquitoes are like really bad in the north. The climate in the Mackenzie Lowlands is relatively mild with warm and dry summers, during which average temperatures July of about 60 degrees Fahrenheit or 16 degrees Celsius are recorded at most of the settlements along the Mackenzie River. The winters are long and cold. The average temperature in January of negative 16 degrees Fahrenheit or negative 26 degrees Celsius. At Yellow River, on the northern shore of Great Slave Lake, north and east of Timberland, the Arctic climate prevails. Annual precipitation is light, and although average winter temperatures are similar to those in the subarctic regions to the west, temperatures do not rise above an average of 50 degrees Fahrenheit or 10 degrees Celsius, even in July. American Indians, or First Nations, make up more than one-third of the territorial population, including the Dene and the Métis. Concentrated in the Mackenzie Valley area, the Dene belong to the several tribes, all part of the Athabascan language family. Tribal organization was never strong among the Dene. The small bands led by individuals chosen for their skills in the hunt were the effective social unit. This arrangement was easily molded to the needs of the fur trade when it reached the Mackenzie area in the 18th century. Thereafter, the exchange of furs was for imported goods became the basis of any economy. Government treaties were made with the groups living south of Great Slave Lake in 1899 and with those living farther north only in 1921. No reservations were established, but a substantial number of small indigenous settlements have the same status as reservations elsewhere. The decline of the fur trade in the 20th century left many Dene unemployed. The Métis, people of mixed Indian and European ancestry, were granted legal recognition as a native group by the Canadian government in 2003. Costing about one-tenth of the population, the Inuit, Aboriginal Arctic people of Canada, called Eskimo in the United States, are found mainly in the northern coastal portions of territories. They are distinct from the Dene in language and culture and generally live apart from them. The vast majority of Canadian Inuit are found in Nunavut. The remainder of the people in the territories are mainly of European descent. Most live in this more accommodating advanced Fort Smith region, where they find employment in mining, transportation, public service. Most of this population has also been in transit. The Aboriginal peoples of territories once led nomadic lives. The Inuit, in particular, survived by adapting to the harsh natural environment. But this balance was disturbed when Europeans established permanent settlements and introduced firearms, resulting in the drastic depletion of the barren ground caribou, an important food source. Attempting to introduce domestic reindeer and other domestic animals has not been successful. Most Aboriginal people now live in towns and small settlements. Although hunting and fishing continue to provide some food, these settlements rely on imported food, fuel, and other necessities. The territories are among the most sparsely populated and habitable regions of the world. Nearly all the population lies in small settlements along the Mackenzie River, with small numbers along the Arctic coastline of the mainland and northern islands. In addition to Yellowknife, the main towns are Hay River, Fort Smith, and Inuvik. All are in the Mackenzie area. In the late 20th and early 21st centuries, the territories have much lower rates of international immigration than the Canadian provinces. They also tended to lose more residents to interprovincial migration than they gained. The economy of territories depends on the exploitation of natural resources. However, high production costs and transportational problems inhibit the development of many of the territories. Mineral resources, including the petroleum and natural gas fields that exist in the Western Arctic coastal regions, services play a specific role in the economy, but manufacturing is negligible. Because royalties and other revenues from natural resources used in the territories are collected by the federal government, the Territorial Commission Administration relies on funds transferred to it from the federal authority for most of its revenues. A government assistance in the development of major resources has been provided mainly in the form of roads, electric power facilities, mapping, and geological services. Government agencies produce and distribute electric power through the territories and provide certain transportation services. Although there are areas of arable lands in the southern part of the Mackenzie Valley, farming is not profitable. Some field crops are grown for local use, but most foodstuffs must be imported, greatly increasing the price. The Fort Smith region has most of the territories, approximately 130,000 square miles or 330 square kilometers of forested land. Even there, large settings of marketable timbers are not plentiful. Several sawmills process their timber only for local use. Trapping continues to provide income for some of the Aboriginal population. Muskrat, beaver, marten, mink, and lynx are the most important furs taken in the Mackenzie area. While Arctic fox remains the principal fur in the Arctic regions, fishing and hunting of sea mammals also provide some employment. Whitefish, lake trout, pickerel, and northern pike are fished commercially on Great Slave Lake and some smaller lakes. Seals and some small whales are hunted for food. and some sealskins are marketed commercially. Mining has been the principal non-renewable resource industry of the territories. Gold has been mined at Yellowknife on the North Shore of Great Slave Lake since the late 1930s. Radioactive ores were mined at Port Meridian on Great Bear Lake in the 1930s, initially to produce uranium, later during World War II, and afterward uranium was mined. Large-scale lead and zinc mining was carried on at Pine Point from the late 1960s till the 1980s, when the ore deposit became depleted. Smaller metal mining projects have been carried out as well as scattered sites. Few in the high Arctic regions, silver, copper, tungsten, and chameleon are among the minerals that have been produced. Diamonds were first discovered at Lake Degoss, northeast of Great Slave Lake in 1991, setting off a regional boom that led to the discovery of several other commercially significant diamond-bearing properties. First commercial production of diamonds began in 1998. Petroleum fuels were used in territories arcane from refineries located in Norman Wells and Pointed Mountain Fields. Mackenzie Delta and Benefort Sea are also substantial oil and gas reserves. Gasoline and diesel fuel are important for both transportation and for electric power generation. Large-scale hydroelectric power development has not been feasible, but a number of small sites have been developed to supply power to local industries and communities. Although mining is the dominant industry in the territories, services constitute about a part of the economy. At the beginning of the 21st century, about half of the labor force was employed in various service industries. Another fifth of the labor force worked in public administration. Tourism is an important portion of the service sector, and adventure tours, driving tours, sports fishing, hunting, and such natural phenomena as the Aurora Borealis and long summer days attract visitors from other parts of Canada, Japan, and the United States. Nearly all passengers and much freight traffic is carried by air services. Flights link Yellowknife and other major settlements along the Mackenzie Valley and the Edmonton Alta. Service transportation for heavy freight is mainly by water. Waterway is supplement in the southern part of the Fort Smith region by the Mackenzie Highway and the railway connecting Hay River to the Trans-Canada rail system in Alberta. A highway that runs from Fort Simpson links the southern Mackenzie Valley to the Alaska Highway in Yukon. Also, the North Mackenzie Delta is connected to the Austin Yukon by the Dempster Highway.
Hey guys, this is Heather and Kristen, the hosts of Sinister Sweethearts podcast, and we want to share with you a little bit about our show.
If you're looking for fun banter between old college sweetmates about all things paranormal, sinister, weird, and generally creepy, check out our podcast available on Apple Podcasts, Spotify, Stitcher, or your favorite podcast player.
Tractor trains and other overland vehicles using temporary winter roadways carry freight into the remote areas. Snowmobiles are used for light winter travel. Okay. Ultimate constitutional responsibility for government and the territories rests with the federal government, not the law. But most provisional responsibilities have been delegated to a territorial administration in the old night. The administration consists of a commissioner who is appointed by the federal government and the legislative assembly, whose members are directly elected to 4-year terms. The assembly reflects the statistic ethnic mix of the territorial population. There is no system of political parties, and the decision making in the assembly is by consensus, determined by majority vote. Members of assemblies choose a speaker, a government leader known locally as the premier, and executive council or cabinet, whose members are appointed to various ministerial portfolios by the government leader. Ordinary members not elected to the Executive Council constitute an unofficial opposition. Executive Council is responsible for the overall direction of government policy in the territories and manages the legislative agenda of the territorial administration. All legislation is technically subject to the asset of the commissioner. The commissioner's role is mainly ceremonial. The territories are represented by one elected 10-member in the Canadian House of Commons since 1999, by one appointed member in the Canadian Senate. Justice is dispensed by a territorial court system, police magistrate, and several justices of the peace. Law enforcement is carried out by the local Canadian Mounted Police. The federal government administers the territories' natural resources through part of Indian and Northern Affairs Canada. Missionaries provide nearly all the education and health care available in territories until the 1950s. Since then, both have been mainly government responsibilities. The Territorial Department of Education, Culture, and Employment provides elementary and secondary schooling, and a number of post-secondary programs and courses offered by community college systems at several centers throughout the territories. Since the 1970s, local control of education has been strengthened through the development of elected local and regional administrative bodies. Many Aboriginal settlements have been provided with schools under federally sponsored programs aimed at improving access to elementary and secondary education for Aboriginal children. That's cool. The territorial government also gives financial assistance to many students who pursue post-secondary education either inside or outside the territories. Healthcare is provided through comprehensive territorial hospital and medical service insurance plans. Territorial Acts Council, established in 1985, advises the Territorial Minister of Education, Culture, and Employment on policies regarding the arts. It also recommends financial awards for various arts projects. The Prince of Wales Northern Heritage Center in Yellowknife is dedicated to preserving the culture and heritage of the people and of territories. In addition to providing many services and programs throughout the territories, the center houses a territorial museum and archives. The center's permanent collection of works of art, agricultural artifacts, and natural specimens have become an important tourist attraction. Amateur sports are promoted by Sport North, a federation of territorial sports organization. Athletes from the Northwest Territories also regularly participate in the biennial Arctic Winter Games, which athletes from northern regions around the world compete in a variety of modern and traditional games and sports. Modern form of transportation and communication have been done much to break down the isolation of life in the North and contrary North American popular culture is evident in most communities. Radio, satellite, television, and internet have made a wide range of entertainment and educational material available in even the most remote settlements. Radio stations relay programs throughout the territories. Most of the large settlements have their own weekly newspapers. Some even have local television stations that originate programs for distribution in territories. Public funding supports local programming to help revitalize the linguistic and cultural heritage of the Dene. Pretty cool place. Pretty lot of stuff going on. Vikings probably visited parts of the Canadian Arctic during the Middle Ages. There are no records of exploration until a voyage in 1576 of the English mariner Martin Frostbisher in search of the Northwest Passage to the Orient. Expeditions in the 17th century also failed to find the route, but they added the knowledge of the Arctic regions. Interest in finding the route waned in the 18th century, but whaling ships became commonplace in Arctic waters. First recorded exploration of the mainland was by Samuel Hearn, who in 1770 to 1772 journeyed from the northwest coast of Hudson Bay to the mouth of Coppermine River on the northern coast. Other inland explorations were mainly the work of Montreal fur-based fur traders. In 1789, Alexander Mackenzie of the Northwest Company traveled down the river and bears his name to reach the Arctic Ocean. 19th century, there was a renewal interest in the finding Northwest Passage. Sir John Franklin and others explored much of Mackenzie District, now largely the regions of Fort Smith and Inuvik, Northwest Territories, and Kitikmeot and Nunavut, and mapped parts of the northern coastline during the 1820s. Work that Thomas Simpson continued in 1838-1839. Searches for the Lost Franklin Expedition of 1845-1848 explored, mapped out other parts of the Eastern Arctic in the following decade. Later, a series of expeditions attempted to reach the North Pole. This exploit continued until the 20th century, but then were overshadowed by more practical activities directed at identifying the resources potentials of the North. Settlements were first established to serve the whaling fleets and fur traders. Missionaries became active in the Mackenzie Valley in 1852 and the Eastern Arctic towards the end of the century. No resident administrative authorities were established within the present limits of the Northwest Territories until the 20th century. Responsibilities for the mainland territories that drained into Hudson Bay, known as Rupert's Land, was vested in the Hudson Bay Company, the remaining part of the mainland, the Northwestern Territory, under nominal British rule until 1870, at which time both it and Rupert's Land were ceded to Canada. In 1880, the Arctic Island mainland by British also were placed under Canadian jurisdiction. Separation of the Yukon Territory, now Yukon, creation of the new provinces, and enlargement of other provinces reduced the Northwest Territories to its pre-1999 limits by 1912. The Royal Canadian Mounted Police were made responsible for taking law and order and providing whatever governmental administration required in the area. Fur traders, missionaries, and the police directed the life of the Northwest Territories until the 1920s. The discovery of oil near Fort Norman on the Mackenzie River prompted the Canadian government to establish a territorial administration for the area. Mining replaced the fur trade as the most important industry in the Mackenzie District in the 1930s. You know, because the stuff ran out, as you know, right about earlier. And he's just. World War II brought much government finance construction activities to territories. In the southern Mackenzie area, the Canal Pipeline linking the oil fields at Norman Wells to a refinery at Whitehorse, Yukon, construction of several large airfields in the Eastern Arctic did much to open the Canadian North to further exploration and development. After the war, construction of the Mackenzie Highway to Great Slave Lake, and the building of this early warning radar network, the DEW line, continued this process. Meanwhile, a great expansion of government sponsored health, education, and welfare services transformed living and social conditions throughout the North. Pace of development slowed in the 1970s, in part because of growing opposition on the part of Aboriginal groups, commercial exploitation of resources in the area. An inquiry conducted by Thomas R. Berger, a Canadian Supreme Court justice, into a proposed Mackenzie Valley natural gas pipeline led to increased public concern over environmental issues in the region and recognition of Aboriginal land claims and other rights. Subsequent litigations involving Aboriginal groups and the federal and territorial governments led to a number of new agreements, procedures that address those concerns, and procedures that address those concerns. Most fundamental change was embodied in the Nunavut Act, ratified in 1993. Act created territory of Nunavut on the eastern portion of the Northwestern Territories. After a traditional period, Nunavut came to being on April 1, 1999. In the early 21st centuries, natural resources nation continued to influence, of course, of economic development in the Northwest Territories. Energy and diamond mining industries playing prominent roles at the same time. Environmental issues remained important, and politics made efforts to resolve Aboriginal land claims and related issues of Aboriginal self-government. The territorial government also increased its effort to to resolve Aboriginal land claims and related issues of Aboriginal self-government. The federal government also increases efforts to deal with it, such as social problems at high rates of suicide and substance abuse, especially among the young. By Kenneth John Reed. Thank you, Ken, for writing that. Britannica.com. Alright, time for some cryptids. What's the history and colony line for geography of Northwest Territories of Canada? Nunavut, or Man in the Bush. It's a cryptozoological hominid reported in the National Park Reserve near Nunavut, Northwest Territories, Canada, April and June 1964, by John Baptist. Several men and a boy named Jerry, several days in from Portland and Lillard, were trapping a river early upon the creature in April 1964. It's described as Bigfoot-like creature, but less ape and more Neanderthal-like in resemblance. About 5 feet tall, also had long dark beard and wore no clothes. In June 1964, near Fort Simpson, around 9 p.m., a boy named Gary reported a similar creature. It had black hair on his head, upper body, and legs, and a black beard. So he pointed at the back. It also had a long brown beard that reached his waist, and wore ankle-high boots and moose-skin loincloth, possibly moose-skin boots, and had a stone club in his hand. These creatures have been reported for hundreds of years, and are said to have been have boot-like footprints and whistling calls. They were reported from the Northwest Territories to Yukon to the Kenai Peninsula in Alaska. Sounds like a caveman. Next up, Wahila. Similar to the Ontario White Wolf, and often considered to be the same animal, the Wahila, or Sable Wolf, is a large wolf-like creature said to inhabit Alaska and Northwest Territories. It is larger and more heavily built than normal wolves, with a wide head and proportionally larger feet, and with a long, pure white fur. The animal's hind legs are said to be shorter than the front legs. According to the front legs, and tracks show widely spaced toes. Witnesses described it as being about 3.5 feet to 4 feet at the shoulder. While they are never seen in packs, so they are presumably solitary. Many of the legends describe the Wahili as an evil spirit with supernatural powers and describe it as killing people and removing their heads. It has been theorized that the Wahili is an amphibious prehistoric carnivore of the Messine and Altene, a dire wolf, a large wolf of the Pleistocene, a prehistoric hyena, or a completely new species of canine. The Wahili is native to the Lahaina or Hellas Valley, as it is known for ripping people's heads off. It is mostly in Native American legends, but it was cited by American mechanic Frank Graves, who described it as a wolf on steroids, most likely because of its build and size. 2018, original eyewitness Graves identified the animal he saw as a Kinsey timber wolf, Canis lupus nidalis, a known gray wolf subspecies inhabited in Canada. Documentary interview with a cryptid hunter. The Wahili appears in the anime cartoon The Secret Saturdays. It also appears in the movie game The Secret Saturdays Beast of the Fifth Sun. And on a reality TV show, the Wahili is haunted on Alaska Monsters. So we got a damn. What's the place from Game of Thrones? Shadow?
Hello, everyone. This is Brandon, the host of the ParaUnity Podcast, wanting to take a second to tell you about our show. The ParaUnity Podcast is your top choice for closing the distance between the paranormal groups. From ghosts, to cryptids, to ufology, we will discuss it all. The ParaUnity Podcast is aimed at promoting positivity and collaboration between investigators, and is geared specifically for those in the field. But if you're not, you'll still get a kick out of the show as well, because you'll be able to think of it like ghost hunters talking shop. Tune in and join myself and all of our amazing guests as we entertain you with sensational stories of fantastic places, events, tips for your investigations, and so much more. And remember, you can find the ParaUnity Podcast on your favorite podcast directory and part of the Paranormality Radio Network.
The occult. In Inuit mythology, occult, pronounced occult or occult, is a occult. It's like a same word, but one starts with a, another starts with o. It's a spirit. It's A-K-H-L-U-T. It's a spirit that takes the form of both a wolf and an orca. It is a vicious, dangerous beast. Its tracks can be recognized because there are hoof tracks that lead to and from the ocean. Often, dogs seen walking to the ocean and or into it are considered evil. Little is known of the spirit other than that it shapeshifts from an orca to a wolf when hungry. Not many myths relate to this creature. A great number of myths tell of creatures that shift their shape. It is normally portrayed as a mix of an orca and a wolf. It has been said that this is a dangerous creature, but most of the Inuit do not know what was attacking them while trying to fish out of the Arctic Sea. The only thing they can think of was the wolf tracks coming out of the water. The aqualite is very vicious and even attacks you if you were falling asleep near the edge. Sometimes it goes as far as the Inuit camp to snatch them up. It has a furious appetite and would eat anything that's close by. There are many stories of how the aqualite comes to be, but this legend is the most popular. It's about a man who is obsessed with the sea and wants to be with it all the time. After coming off the shore, he turns to the village, but people don't recognize him because he has become too obsessed with the ocean and he gets banned from the village. While on his own, he finds packs of wolves, and because he is so hungry, like a wolf for revenge, he becomes one of them. One day, his affection for ocean becomes so insane that he jumps into the ocean to be with it. He then transforms into an orca. Thus, he now swims as an orca, being at ease, but whenever he's hungry for revenge, is once again awoken, comes to land, and transforms into a wolf. Wolves can swim in icy water. This will be an explanation as to why there are always footprints leading out of the water. There are also the exploration of a chunk of ice the wolf was coming from, going to, simply broke off. Either was the wolf still on it, or was the wolf already having left but a few meters away. The second solution is somewhat more mysterious, as to some kind of myth. It says that sometimes when Arctic wolves are being attracted by a pack, they would commit suicide by jumping in the cold, icy water and drown themselves. This is rather odd, however, because several instincts should prevent them from doing that, because it is a very strong animal. Interestingly, another name for an orca is a sea wolf, stemming from a time when it was believed that ocean and land shared variants of the same animals, hence the well-known seahorse and sea cow, as well as lesser-known creatures such as the monkfish and sea bees. Possible explanations are descendant of Angus, a large wolf, or descendant of Pegasus. The aqualite appears in the mobile smartphone app game Disco Zoo, where it fills the Ice Age exhibits. Mythical creatures spot. Randomly, people walking in the fields will call them walking orcas or orca dogs or probably whales. In the movie Sharktopus vs. Werewolf has been likened to Aqualit. In the song The Hedgehog comic series, a character named Aqualit worked as one of Dr. Eggman's generals. Wolf drop wolf. Wolf or white wolf. Ooh. Inuit mythological creatures and element beings. So we're told by Inuit elders are full of fantastic creatures, spirits, and strange beings. Here are some examples of figures from our rich Northern mythology. Studies and details from the region in the north. If you want to learn more about these mythological beings, talk to elders in your community. So, Tarak Suit are known as the Shadow People. They live in a world like our own. The world, however, is beyond our senses. They are almost never seen, but sometimes when conditions are right, the Tarak Suit can be heard. Have you ever heard the sounds of footsteps or the sound of talking or laughing in the distance, but not seeing the one around? Maybe it was a Tarak Suit. Sometimes these shadow beings are noticed or people sense their presence. When this happens, their suits seem to be disappear to the ground and vanish. Stories tell us that some Inuit have crossed over to this shadow world, but few have ever returned to tell us what it's like. Instead, if the Tarak Suit invite you to cross over to their world for a visit, would you go? The Lidjarat are the shapeshifters. These land spirits are elusive and can transform into any arctic animal to disguise themselves. Most often they take shape of a raven, bear, wolf, or even a human. The only part of the Inuit cannot disguise are their eyes. In all of its forms, both human and animals, their eyes are always red. These elusive creatures are portrayed as evil and malicious in many stories. These stories are ones that lie in wait for lone travelers, changing shape to fool close to them. Some elders argue that these land spirits are not inherently evil, but rather misunderstood. Elders believe that the Lidjarat often appear to bring messages to travelers. One elder warned that these spirits are surrounded by mirages. When the mountains on the horizon look bigger or closer, that they really are the Lidjarat might be near. Although many interpretations of the Lidjarat exist, one thing is certain: after an encounter with the Lidjarat, people tend to experience memory loss and quickly forget the details of what happened. If you ever encounter the Lidjarat, remember to talk to as many people as possible before your memory begins to fail and you completely forget the experience. The Kukla Katak or Agna Kukla Glenog is a monstrous three-fingered claw that can emerge from any surface to grab children who are stealing. This monstrous appendage will hold the little thief until someone comes and witnesses the crime. Though a large claw hand seems frightening and evil, Cthulhu is only trying to keep children honest and respectful. If children do not learn to respect the property of others, then maybe a Cthulhu will teach them to do so when one else is around. The Maha, or Tickler. Maha is a mechanical demon that is said to have terrorized parts of the Arctic long ago. This creature is a thin, sinewy being, ice blue in color and cold to the touch. Maha's eyes are white and piercing, and they peer through the long, stringy hair that hangs over its face. This demon is extremely strong and is also barefooted and almost naked. Maha is a stealthy creature that creeps up on Inuit when it gets close enough. Maha delights in tickling its victims to death with his sharp, vicious nail attached to his long, bony finger. The only warning a victim can even receive is the giggles of Simon Maha cannot hang as it approaches. Maha's unfortunate victims face an ongoing death of screams and laughter as they are tickled to the breath leaves their bodies. Many elders have commented on the horribly twisted smiles left on the face of Maha victims. Although this demon is vicious and evil, Maha is easily fooled. Most of the stories told about Maha end with being deceived. Usually, Maha is tricked to learning over a water hole to take a drink and is pushed into the ocean to open water and swept away by the current. So, if Maha ever comes to you alone, ask it to have one last drink with you by the water hole so you can push it in. Aqualopulid. There are many creatures of the old Arctic waters. They're often described as having scaly and bumpy skin, not unlike a sculpin. It is said that these ugly creatures reek of sulfur. The Aqualopic are pulled are child snatchers. No one really knows why these creatures love to take children. Perhaps they take children because they are lonely in the company. Like the company, or maybe they like how children taste. Many stories of Aqualopic tell them wearing elder duck clothing with large pouches on their backs to carry children in. Aqualopic hide in the ocean, waiting for children to play alone on the beach or near the breaking ice. Usually the Aqualopic jump out of the water and grab children without any warning. Sometimes, however, you can hear them knocking under the ice. Some elders have said that if the ocean comes wavy or steam begins to rise from the water, a Aqualopic might be hiding under the sea. One thing is certain, whether a Aqualopic is hiding from the water in the water or not, it's never safe to play alone on the beach or near the broken panes of ice, of sea ice. The Tunit, these are people who lived in the north before the Inuit. These beings spoke a simple language, sometimes referred to as Kutak or Baby Talk. The Tunit were a peaceful people who mind their own business. If left alone, artifacts of the Tunit can be found all over the north. The Tunit were the same height as river people, however, they were thick-boned and extremely strong. If angry with the Tunit, were a powerful enemy. If you ever come across a strong, thick-bodied person dressed in skins and using the tools of our ancestors, it might be one of Tunit. This being begins to speak, answer slowly and don't use big words. Incubacuas are the northern giants. Very little is known about these huge creatures. Incubacuas are rarely seen. Already seen and almost never talked about by elders. Seems that the males are larger and less common than the females. Very little is known of the males. Perhaps this is because no one has ever survived to talk about them. Female incubacuas seem to be more common. These incubi find humans amusing and will catch them to use as playthings. Some elders warn that females will grab people and carry them away in their amulet. You ever seen an incubus crouch down and remain very still? Your best chance to escape is to avoid. So, I think the tickler is pretty crazy. And the that's it for this episode. Thank you for listening, and I'll see you next week. Happy Thanksgiving, happy Christmas, Merry Christmas, happy holidays. Maybe, I'm going.
Thank you for listening to this episode of the Monster Legend Podcast.
Hope you were able to find us on Twitter and Instagram and Facebook. We also have our own website at monsterlegendpodcast.com. If you'll be so kind to please leave a review and subscribe and let me know what I can do to make this show better for you. If you have any stories you'd like to submit or you'd like to be a guest, send me an email or a DM. But I hope you do one thing that's really important and have a great day. Thank you.